The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab.
This is Amanda Pond, and I'm pleased to be speaking today with Richard Savino, who is the leader and founder of the early music ensemble El Mundo. El Mundo recently received the wonderful news that it has been nominated for a Grammy in the category of Best Small Ensemble Performance for its CD entitled The Kingdoms of Castile. Richard Savino is joining us from the studio of Capital Public Radio, which is on the campus of Sacramento State University, where he is a professor of music. Welcome, Richard, and many congratulations. Can you please tell us how you heard about this very special nomination?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for having me on this show. Amanda, it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm a big fan of Sunday Baroque. It was a very funny way that I found out. I was just coming back from a rehearsal with a group that I play with occasionally. This was something peripheral, just they hired me because they know I do a lot of this music, of Latin American music from the 17th century. And it was late. I was driving back from Stanford University to my home. And I got a phone call somewhere about 10 or 11 at night saying, congratulations, congratulations. And I was like, for what? Well, you're a Grammy-nominated artist. And it was really quite exciting. We're all thrilled. The whole group is quite thrilled.
That's great.
It's a great honor.
Well, you must be celebrating. Well, I see that you recorded over 30 CDs. So when you completed the recording of The Kingdoms of Castile, did you realize that this was particularly special and likely to receive any kind of award or nomination?
When we completed it, I knew we had a great CD in the can. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of program that we've been performing as a group for over 10 years, and it gestated over that period of time. We had a chance to test things out and experiment, which you don't often get a chance to do. Mm-hmm. I was frustrated that I hadn't recorded it earlier, but in, you know, retrospect, now I think it was a brilliant idea because we had this opportunity once again to just go through everything so many times, mm-hmm, and experiment with instrumentation, improvisations. It was great. I'm very pleased with the way it came out.
Well, much of the music on the recording was written in places like southern Italy that happened to be under Spanish rule at the time. But some listeners might be surprised to actually discover a cantata by Handel, a composer that perhaps only academics and music historians might associate with Spain. How did you come to choose this particular piece?
Well, I had known that this cantata had existed. I had done quite a bit of work studying Handel when he was in Rome and Naples. The Ruspoli documents, documents his existence and whereabouts and his activities there. And I knew this cantata existed. It's in a really sort of archaic manuscript. It's in his hand. Mm-hmm. And he says on the top, it's his only piece that says Cantata a voce sola. He uses the Italian. Con chitarra español, and then the text is all in Spanish, and it's the kind of work that when you look at it, you go, "What was he thinking?" It doesn't look like much of anything, but when you go beneath the surface, and you realize, Handel, he's so brilliant. He's the great chameleon. He writes it in an Italian structure, a da capo aria, Richard Tative, da capo aria, but it's filled with all those unique Spanish rhythms and Spanish harmonies. And more to the point, most people have misinterpreted the manuscript. They think that one of the lines that's written there, that's an obbligato line, is a guitar part. Now, the Baroque guitar for that period can't play it where it's written. He's very specific about clefs. And I just said, you know, basically he's just telling you to strum a guitar, improvise an accompaniment to this, which was the Neapolitan and Italian and Spanish Baroque practice of the
right.
time.
That was the way.
Precisely. And it's a great short little gem. I still to this day think that Handel is the greatest composer who ever lived because of his ability to exploit the wonderful genre of opera the way he did.
Yes.
But every genre, you know. And there is a lot of music from the south of Italy that is, in fact, Spanish music, primarily because, obviously, it was the seat of the Spanish viceroys in Naples. Actually, very close to where my father's family is from, there was a Spanish palace, some kind of a summer palace in the town of Teggiano. And also because of the nature of the laws governing publishing in Spain during the 16th through 18th centuries, they basically exported lots of music to Italy to be published in Italy. Juan de Aranjuez did his big collections there. Gaspar Sanz says that he studied there and he went there. Most Spanish musicians did not publish in Spain.
And few people realize the extent of the Spanish Empire, I think, you know, and the influence.
Well, especially then. I mean, and it's a, you know, it's a controversial subject. Let's be very, very frank about this. But from a musical perspective, it's an incredibly rich and rewarding subject.
Mm-hmm.
There are some real unique things, like from the Viceroyalty of Mexico, which included at the time Guatemala. The Guatemala City Cathedral is filled with extraordinary pieces. And we play one piece here that's you wouldn't have found in Spain. It's Oigan Una Jacaria by Rafael Castellanos.
Right.
And a jacara is a piece that would have been played in Spanish theater pieces. It's a lascivious kind of dance, and it usually accompanies a pickpocket, a thief, a thug. And it, in this context, they're using that kind of a secular work and co-opting it for sacred religious purposes to celebrate Christmas. It becomes a Christmas villancico. It's what, as I say in my notes, it's what Vatican II could have been.
I saw that. I was rather intrigued by that comment. But there are also several other beautiful vocal works on the recording. And what struck me most was the contrast between them. Can you please tell us about some of your other selections and why you chose them?
Well, for instance, José Marín and Juan Hidalgo are two of my favorite 17th century Spanish composers. Hidalgo was very involved with theater music, was a harpist, actually was the uncle, I believe, to the great guitarist Santiago de Murcia. And José Marín was a guitarist himself who was a very controversial figure. He was a priest who was implicated in a murder plot, publicly defrocked and, I believe, whipped, thrown out of Madrid, caught trying to sneak back in. I love this guy. and he wrote beautifully, beautiful music.
Mm-hmm.
And it exists in a variety of different manuscript sources, but the primary one is in Cambridge right now and has a sketch of a guitar part. It's not a continuo part. It's not just a bass line. Mm-hmm. It's a tablature part, but it's only a sketch of one. So you get an idea of the way he actually would have played it.
I see.
And we take it from there, and then we embellish and work off of that. Those two are like the icons of great 17th century Spanish writers. We did the recording before this, which is my third favorite one, the composer, and that's Sebastián Durón. But that was my choice from the core of the Castilian sort of repertory. Mm-hmm. From Naples and southern Italy, obviously, we have Francesco Minelli, Handel. Even though Minelli and Mazzocchi, the two pieces on this, aren't, they're both in Italian, and they're both Italian composers. And the point was we do a set in concert that's based on the Ciccone and pieces that contain Cicconas.
Mm-hmm.
So we put a few of those pieces on this because the Ciccone is, in fact, a Spanish dance. And these, coming from southern Italy, were clearly influenced by that Spanish style.
Mm-hmm.
So the Minelli contains a Ciccone within it. It's not a vibrant Ciccone. It's a very sort of beautiful pastoral one. It's more based on just the chord progression itself. Then the Mazzocchi's Sdegno Campione Audace has a vigorous Ciccone in it.
That's clearly a marvelous piece. I absolutely love that. Yeah.
It's really quite dramatic. And then you have the Ciccone by Falconieri, Falconieri's, every one of his pieces is dedicated to a member of the Spanish nobility living in Naples.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then we have a few from South America.
Sure.
You know, the Aparicio and the Domenico Zippoli, another Italian who went to, became a Jesuit and went to South America.
Yes, actually, I had a question coming up about that because you have this excerpt from the first act of his mission opera, San Ignacio, which is attributed to Domenico Zippoli. And like St. Ignatius himself, Zippoli was a Jesuit priest. And this extract covers some basic philosophical questions such as, who am I? And who am I called to be? And I was sort of intrigued.
Where am I going?
Was there any particular reason why you chose this rather enigmatic subject to be on the recording, and particularly as the final piece?
Well, that when you create a recording like this, you have to determine whether or not it's going to have a flow to it purely just from an acoustical and aesthetic level.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are certain philosophical ones. You know,
yeah.
To me, it was sort of a double entendre, concluding it with that. The text, who am I called to be? Where am I going? What's going to be the next project? This was actually sort of a silly nod in my own mind to John Lennon and the end of the Revolver record, where he, on the song Tomorrow Never Knows, that he goes into this, it's based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and the record ends, but of the beginning, and then they make that move to Sergeant Pepper. There's this huge, complete shift where the Beatles, as they once were known, no longer exist. And it was sort of, who am I? Who's I?
I see.
Who am I called to be, and where am I going? You know, that was my little pun for myself. And I'm impressed you picked up a little bit on it. Maybe not the Lennon reference.
Well, yeah, you're dating yourself a little bit here, Richard, but that's okay. I think we're all in the same age group here. And
that's a classic. That my daughter, who's only 8 years old, listens to that.
Does she really? Good.
Absolutely. And the other part of that, to answer that question, is I just think the music is beautiful. And
yes.
It makes it's the opening set to the opera, and it just it's a beautiful sequence of a sinfonia, recitatives, and a couple of arias.
Extraordinary. Are there any particular things that you look for in singers performing this kind of music?
Well, absolutely, and I have to say that I'm privileged by working with the singers I've worked with. I play with a lot of opera companies, so I've have quite a deal of quite a great deal of experience accompanying singers. I've played for years with Glimmerglass and now Santa Fe Opera and most of the major opera companies in the States here. The singers that I use, when I find someone I like, I'm extremely faithful to them. And Jennifer Ellis Campani has been on every recording I've done with El Mundo of vocal music. And Nell Snedus and Paul Shipper, all three, they blend beautifully together, as you can hear on the
Mio
Cuore.
Yeah. Did you know them originally in New York way back?
We've known each more or less. We met years ago on different paths. And then finally, when I was putting together these projects, I said, let's do this. I met Jenny, as I call her, in California. But then Jenny moved to New York for a number of years, and my family's all still in New York, and we, you know, would do projects there, and we've toured extensively, you know, all back and forth across the country quite a lot. And same thing with Paul and Nell. And we're all part of the, you know, the coterie of performers who do this kind of thing.
Wow, but super.
But it's a really unique little group.
Yes, it certainly is.
What I like is the fact that they can blend. They can blend early music style, but they can also sing out. As you hear in Sdegno, Campiona d'Alce.
Yes.
You know, Nell just she's an opera singer on that too.
That's terrific. It really is. Well, there are also several rousing instrumental pieces. You mentioned Falconieri. Did the scores require a great deal of editing and reconstruction on your part?
Not the falconry specifically in terms of notes that we play, but the setting, how we were going to accompany, and they're filled with all of these cross rhythms. And yeah. we clearly ornament a lot, but the figuring out where the cross rhythms are that aren't apparent in the score,
mm-hmm.
You only learn that by playing it. And you go, this sounds weird.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds weird. And then finally you go, no, this sounds great. those the pieces were published, and the parts are pretty clear as to what basic notes to play. And then obviously the continuo was something that I designed. I just thought through,
sure.
Okay, I want these instruments playing here, these instruments playing here, and I want these accents. That those were my determinations.
Well, assuming you have the basics already ahead of time before you go to the studio, are you still improvising on the spot while you're making the recording?
Yes.
Yeah, that must
yes.
be
and
terrific
that drives
fun.
Producer, well, it is, but it's what I call running amok.
Yes.
But it drives the producers crazy.
Okay.
But I say, so we have a couple of different versions. Pick one.
Right.
What it means is on those particular segments, you have to use big chunks and you have to get it right,
mm-hmm.
because you can't edit in the middle of somebody's, noodle,
sure.
so to speak.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, there's a particularly wonderful Folia, and I'm a huge Folia fan. This one's from Spain,
right.
In which you and the violinist Adam Lamotte sound extremely virtuosic. Can you tell us how you came to choose this particular Folia and decide on its instrumentation?
This Folia only exists as a single violin line. It's in a manuscript in Madrid, and we don't even know if it's frankly for the violin. Everything that I see on that part
uh-huh.
says to me violin. It's in a treble clef. There are only a couple of double stops. It looks like a violin part.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't say that I found it. I can't remember who actually found the work. I found a lot of music, but I have not found that. I did not find that piece. There was a wonderful, the way I found it was through this wonderful book called Danza y Diferencias, 17th century Spanish instrumental music in 17th century Spain by Maurice Esses. And he did a wonderful study of it as a PhD dissertation and then included it in a second volume of notes.
And
I called Maurice up and talked with him, and then I was able to get a copy of the manuscript. And when I looked at it, I said, Adam, just play this. Let's play it a few times,
yeah.
And I'm going to just make stuff up behind you. I want to see how are you going to articulate?
Yeah.
Where are you going to connect the bow? Where mm-hmm. are you going to add ornamentation? I said, I'm just going to follow you on it.
Mm-hmm.
And we played it through a few times, and that's the nice thing about the gestation is that
yeah.
if you get a chance to play it through a few times in concert,
sure.
and you've played it about 10 or 15 times and you say, okay, this is what I'm going to do. And you have an idea what you're going to do on each variation. But the entire guitar part is made up on that.
Mm,
yeah. I loved it because I felt like I was once again playing a rock band.
Yeah, I love it too. I think everyone will.
It's a great Folia.
When you're putting together a project like this, how do you decide on the balance between the vocal and the instrumental works?
Well, I've done so many instrumental recordings, and Spanish music is dominated by vocal music.
Mm.
I was going to put a couple of guitar solos in this from Spain from the 17th and 18th centuries, but I did that on our previous recordings, and I basically said I have enough Baroque guitar music out there. I just put out a solo recording of Ludovico Roncalli sonatas. Mm-hmm. I said, I got three fantastic singers and a couple of fantastic fiddle players, Adam and Lisa, great mm-hmm. cellist, mm-hmm. gombas, Bill Skeen, harpsichordist, fellow guitarist Paul Saris, I want this to be an ensemble recording. I think it was like Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys, saying, thinking of it production-wise like that. And, saying, these are the harmonies I want.
Uh-huh.
So I basically suppressed my own sort of soloistic tendencies and wanted to sort of have instrumental music and have a flow that would work in the sense that people would want to listen to this through composed, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
Opening Sinfonia was found by a friend of mine in the Biblioteca Catalunya Emilio Moreno, the Sinfonia para Empezar by Scarlatti.
Scarlatti,
obviously,
yeah.
It must have been attached to some kind of theater piece. It's a Sinfonia to begin. Mm-hmm. So, that sounds like a very good way to start.
Absolutely.
And then you know, you already know my story about San Ignacio and the
yes.
John Lennon. So I had the bookends.
Yes, sure.
And then I needed to sort of get an idea of the flow. And I, you know, tried to balance it out between going back and forth between ensemble vocal pieces, a solo vocal piece, instrumental works, more solo pieces, and then ensemble pieces, mm-hmm. ending with the Ignacio. I went through about 10 different versions of the flow on this piece and the balance between instrumental, solo vocal pieces, and ensemble vocal pieces.
Gosh, a lot of work.
It is a. I made all the parts up, mm-hmm. all the parts, all these pieces. I put into Sibelius and printed them up for them so they were nice and clean, and so that the producers had good clean parts. It was very important to mm. that, because you know you have to be efficient.
Absolutely. How long did it take you to do all this? Put it all together.
It was a 3-day recording project.
Okay.
But the way we do these things is, even though we've performed them quite a bit, we sort of have an encampment. I invite everybody to my home in California, and I call my friends and say, hey, can you put up somebody else? Many of us live in California, but the people who don't, we create an encampment, and we eat together, and we rehearse for about 4 or 5 days intensely. And then we take a day off, and then we go into the studio the following day.
Sounds like a lot of work and a lot of fun.
I get to be head chef for a few days, which I love.
Oh, you cook as well. My goodness.
I do cook, yes. If I come back in another life, I'm going to be a chef.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Has the ensemble actually been together for a long time now?
Well, it's... As I've said to a number of different interviewers, it's a malleable ensemble because it's all dictated by the repertoire that we're performing.
Sure.
Because it changes so
right.
much. About a year ago, we put out our recording of a zarzuela, Salir el Amor del Mundo by Sebastián Durón. And for that, we had 26 people on the recording. It was the same core group, but then we hired extras, extra string players and, friends
sure.
and, you know, associates.
Yeah.
When we do 19th century music, which we've done, I did a recording of the music of Mauro Giuliani. I invited my friend Monica Huggett to play on that recording, and we did some violin and guitar sonatas, as well as the Giuliani Concerto.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But we also did chamber music and song cycle I did with Jenny Ellis Campani on that too. It's so it all depends upon the project. Right now I'm going through in my mind what the next couple of projects will be, because I try to plan about 5 years ahead of time, and I've got a couple coming up for this summer, and it just depends upon everybody's schedule, because everyone has to make a living and you have to be understanding for that, you know, of that.
Sure, sure. And when you're touring with the group, I'm sure, get terribly expensive if you have a large ensemble, especially when you've got singers involved. Do most of your programs when you're touring actually contain vocal works as well?
They mostly do. It depends. What you have to do is you have to offer presenters options.
Mm.
You can have the incredibly lush production, or you can have the moderately lush production, or you can have the scaled down production.
Mm.
And also, if it's a tour, you have to determine whether or not, if you have your core dates that you know will cover all your expenses and make sure people are paid a working wage, then you can do a couple of runouts along the way that are midweek engagements. So you have it all depends. It's very specific to the tour period.
I see.
What I've been doing lately is this is really exciting to me, and I'm trying to figure out a way to do this on a DVD project, is I've designed a couple of programs based on the life of artists. I've done one, I've guest directed the Aston Magna Music Festival for on a number of occasions, and I did two of these programs for them. One of which was based on the life of Goya, and another was based on the life of Artemisia Gentileschi. The first one's titled Reflection and Revolution, music in the life of Goya, and it basically shows Spanish music from the late 18th century through the early Romantic period, because that's the way Goya's painting evolves. He began with frescoes, and then he did royal portraits, he did the cartoons, then he does the Caprichos engravings, he does the Tauromaquia, the bullfights, and he ends up with the paintings on the walls of his home in Bordeaux that are black and almost a mix of expressionism and impressionism. And the music really does follow that. And you have to deal with the Inquisition and the Napoleonic invasion. And the other one was on the life of, and while we perform that program, the artwork is projected in a timed sequence while the music is being performed. And that took a lot of coordination.
Yeah.
The other program is titled What Artemisia Heard. Artemisia Gentileschi is one of my favorite painters from the early 17th century. And she was, I wouldn't say contemporary of Caravaggio, but she comes from that school of the chiaroscuro artists. And okay. she is a little younger than Caravaggio, but she had an incredible life. She was born in Rome. She was raped by a colleague of her father's. They sued, her father being the great Orazio Gentileschi, a painter. She then won basically her independence as a painter. She was able to take commissions, which is rare for women. She became very close with quite a few musicians. The circles she traveled in were remarkable. She went from Rome to Florence. She became a very good friend of the composer Francesca Caccini, the daughter of Giulio Caccini at the Medici court. She then goes to Naples, she goes to Genova, she goes to Venice, where she becomes the lover of Nicholas Lanier, viola da gamba and composer, who was working for Charles II as he was acquiring art through the dissolution of the Gonzaga court in Mantua. And she ends up in London to help her father finish a final piece. And her paintings contain tons of musical references. So we've designed a program based on her life, too, and the different cities she was in and what she might have heard in those cities. Paintings projected.
How did you get so much biographical information about her?
She's a really well-known figure. If you know about Artemisia, you suddenly become addicted. If I can put a plug in for a book, there's a great book by Alexandra Lapierre just titled Artemisia. The opening words are... It just grabbed me, and they filled. I could smell Rome in the 17th century. Yeah. It was great.
Yeah, I bet.
Very exciting.
Sounds very, very exciting.
But I think those are projects I really want to pursue in a DVD format, so you could have these paintings unfold in the background.
Oh, mixed media.
While you're listening to music. You know, everyone has these big screen TVs these days, and I was thinking, you know, we've become such a visual society, and most people don't know the composers from these environments. Sure. Those of us who are aficionados do, but most people don't know who Corcel is, or Hidalgo, or Marin, or in the Italian world, other than Monteverdi, very few people know early 17th century Italian composers.
Yeah.
But they do know Caravaggio, and they do know Goya, and they do know Gentileschi.
Sure,
And it brings people to the concerts, and it just the integration of the visual as well as the oral is AURAL is. Well, it's one of the things I love doing now.
I see that you're dedicating this, or you have dedicated this recording to your daughter Maria Luisa. Does Maria Luisa play any instruments?
She plays the violin. She plays the piano, and she's an incredibly gifted young flamenco guitarist at the age of eight. Flamenco dancer at the age of eight.
Wow. That's wonderful.
And she's the love of my life, and it's just great.
Are you going to be taking her down with you to the Staples Center? Are you going down for the award ceremony on February 12th?
I'm sorry, I don't think it's an appropriate environment for an 8-year-old.
You'll probably be sitting next to Lady Gaga or something.
Yes, I'm going to wear my meat tuxedo.
Should be fun.
apparently Paul McCartney, I think, is going to be there. Who knows? Now he's doing a concert. He's doing a wonderful concert called Music Cares for musicians who are indigent, who don't have health insurance or, and are elderly and need care. And he's doing a big benefit show the night before.
Oh, that's wonderful.
In LA.
That's terrific.
So he will be there. And I think he's getting a Lifetime Achievement Award. I'm extremely excited.
Oh, I don't blame you. I don't blame you.
Well, it's a great honor, you know.
Before we stop, there's just one aspect of your background that I'd love to hear just a little bit more about, and that is that you have a history of having performed more than one masterclass for Maestro Andres Segovia. Could you please tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, happy to. First of all, I have to say that I was completely ill-equipped for what I was entering into. I had no comprehension of the significance of this. I knew he was the great classical guitarist, and he was, you know, the maestro. But when I got there, the first class was in New York, and I was at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in the Spanish Gardens. And I was one of six people chosen to play in this class that was filmed by PBS. And I met some of my closest friends, like David Tannenbaum, at this class. We sat up there and we're both like, oh, my God, what are we about to do?
Sure.
Because suddenly, you know, you see PBS everywhere, and it's a very select group of people who are invited to this class to watch the class. And that was my very first encounter. And then he accepted me into a series of classes he offered at the Conservatoire de Musique in Geneva, and I spent 3 weeks with him there, and we played for him every day in front of an audience. And that was filmed by CBS, and I was like, oh, my God. You know, the pressure is serious here.
How many years ago was this?
I was in the early 80s. He was quite elderly.
Okay.
I was in the early 80s, and then somehow he took a shine to me. I knew when he was in New York, and I just called the hotel desk and I said, can I please speak with Maestro Segovia? and he answers the phone. And I remind him who I am, and he says, and I said, I'd like to play for you someday. And he invites me up to his penthouse.
Wow.
And I spent 2 hours just one-on-one with him. And I can't say that it was sort of this, you know, sort of technical and intense coaching. It wasn't. It was like an epiphany of the sort that one has when you meet a bodhisattva, you know, a holy man.
Yeah.
It was, okay, just take me by the hand, take me where you've been and go. And just to make that connection was fantastic.
Well,
it was an enlightenment.
Absolutely unforgettable. And I think we're all rooting for you here at WSHU, and wishing you all the best on February 12th. It's an absolutely wonderful CD, and thank you so much for talking to us today.
It's my pleasure, and I'd like to give thanks to a couple of other folks.
Okay.
All the members of my group.
Sure.
You guys are fantastic. My parents, who put up with me being a maniac of a child. And my friends Elia Fisk and Albert Fuller and Jerry Willard. Albert Fuller in particular enlightened me to a path that just showed me the way. And many musicians who were involved in the early music scene in the United States are indebted to Albert, and that's in Albert's memory that this is very important. And also the recently deceased Annette Simmons from Los Angeles, who was a huge, huge supporter of me.
Good. Well,
so thank you all.
Well, thank you, Richard. It's been fascinating speaking with you today.